With regard to the flow of our activities this afternoon, it's a straightforward and simple procedure. We will first hear from Dr. Stephen Carter. He will give a presentation. Then he will be followed in order by Dr. Jessica Boone, Assistant Professor of Church History, and Dr. Charles Wood, the Layman Professor of Christian Doctrine here at Perkins. There's no necessary coincidence, but Dr. Boone was on sabbatical leave in the fall. Dr. Wood is on sabbatical leave now. The moral of the story is not necessarily that if you go on sabbatical leave, you get hauled back into service anyway for events of this kind, but simply because these two distinguished scholars who bring different perspectives and different gifts are uniquely equipped to help us engage Professor Carter in the conversation. Stephen Carter is a leading public intellectual in law, religion, and culture. He is the author of 8 books, I believe that's the correct count, nonfiction, scholarly works, and 4 fiction works, novels. He has, in the course of his career, fulfilled a number of activities of public service and witness, in addition to his decades of teaching at the law school at Yale. Among other things in his career, he was a clerk at the Supreme Court for Associate Justice Thurgood Marshall. He is William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Law Institute, a trustee of the Aspen Institute, and a member of the National Commission on Judicial Discipline and Removal. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Stephen Carter to the Perkins community today, and also for this symposium. A briefer word of introduction can be offered about my 2 colleagues who will participate first in the response to Dr. Carter and then in the conversation publicly to follow. Dr. Jessica Boone has been a member of the Perkins faculty now for 5 years. Her specialty is late medieval, early modern history. Her more specific area of expertise includes late medieval Spanish mysticism. She spent her fall sabbatical in Spain, and she has done some extraordinary work in her teaching, bridging an interesting gap that exists between this side of Bishop Boulevard and that side of Bishop Boulevard, in that she has enabled her students of church history to appreciate the way in which the art in the Meadows Museum is linked inevitably to the history, church history, that is taught here. Charles Wood, who earned his PhD at the same university that Stephen Carter calls his professional home. Charles Wood is an ordained United Methodist minister, a clergy member of the Rocky Mountain Annual Conference, and holds the position of layman professor of Christian doctrine. Charles has been a servant of the university and the School of Theology in many, many ways, former Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, but most of all, a source of wisdom and insight that all of us have come to trust and value. He will be retiring from the Perkins faculty at the end of this academic year. Please join me in welcoming first Dr. Stephen Carter, who will then, in order, be followed by Dr. Jessica Boone and then Dr. Charles Wood.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. I'd like to repeat what I said at lunch. I'd like to thank the university and particularly the Perkins School and, of course, Dr. Carney and the Carney family as well. It's a great honor to be here. It's a little bit intimidating. As a law professor, I don't often get invited to speak at seminaries or schools of theology. I occasionally do. And each time, to use the sports expression, the commentators, let us say, clean my clock. So I'm going to try to give this talk without a single reference to either church history or church doctrine. To be fair, the commentators haven't really seen my talk. What I sent them, because I had an injury and I couldn't do any typing, an article that I wrote several years ago, many of the themes of which I said I was going to discuss. But now that they've had a chance to look at it, I'm tempted to discuss as few of the themes as I possibly can, lest I be caught in some terribly embarrassing error. I should explain that the reason I wanted to talk about religion in the secular academy in part is because I'm a Christian believer at a secular academy, but also because it's a subject that fascinates many of us and that also mirrors in certain ways the borderline or perhaps the balancing act, as you'll see as a metaphor I prefer, I'll be talking about in a moment, between the two vital aspects of our society. And I want to begin with a brief story. A few years ago, I was up at Northwestern University to give a series of lectures, actually, about just war theory, a series of lectures that actually form part of the heart of the my most recent book. And after I gave the first lecture, in which I talked several times about Christian history and Christian doctrine, but I won't repeat that here. There was a dinner, and at the dinner, a very learned professor of international law at Northwestern, international relations, I suppose, at Northwestern, stood up and asked me, there was a question and answer period, would I have given the same talk if I were not a Christian? And I found this quite a striking question. But it was also a question that I had never considered. You know, when you give a talk academically, you come up with what you think you're going to be asked. But this was something that had never occurred to me. And so I gave a long-winded academic answer that boiled down to, I don't know. But then I went on to say, once I had recovered my bearings, I said, there's a reason I don't know. And I said, the reason I don't know is that the question itself suggests the importance of separating in my own mind what I understand of this subject that somehow has been taught to me independently of my faith, and then the faith through which I analyze the things that are taught to me. And I suggested that while I can understand from the point of view of what I referred to then as an outsider, why someone would want to know how I would separate them, I saw in my own mind no particular necessity of separating them. And I didn't mean by that to reject the notion that it's possible to separate them. I only had never considered it desirable. So shortly after I gave that talk, I was back at Yale, and I was giving a talk about religion and science, which is a subject I've written about a lot over the years. And after this talk, a member of the Yale faculty came up to me. He was a biologist. He wasn't a member of the law faculty. And he said to me, he asked me what I thought of people who believe the biblical story of creation teaching high school biology. And he was against it. He said that he thought that unless you could affirm the theory of evolution as true, you shouldn't teach it. And so I told him a story about when I was an undergraduate, my Economics 1 course was taught by an avowed Marxist who told us in the first day he was an avowed Marxist and that he didn't actually think any of this was true. But he was going to teach it because it was the curriculum. And he was a brilliant teacher, and he taught neoclassical economics wonderfully. And I told him that it struck me that the question itself suggested an odd kind of bias. And the bias I wasn't able to describe well then, but I'm going to try to describe it now. The bias was an epistemological bias. The bias was a bias that suggests that there's a way of viewing the world that is self-evidently correct, and that those who don't view the world that way, while they ought to be tolerated, need not be anything more than tolerated. And I think that this is the view of what I refer to in the title of the paper as the secular academy, that what's wrong with these religionists in the secular view, particularly the secular liberal view, and here I have in mind not so much liberalism as a political position, although there's some of that, but rather the liberal tradition in its modern sense. What's wrong with these religionists is that they don't see the world as it actually is. They see it through the guise of this bizarre epistemology that begins with God's word and goes on from there. I want to try to take a minute and defend, not so much defend that epistemology, it doesn't need a defender here, but rather defend its expression in the secular academy. I feel like I've been quoting Stanley Hauerwas all day. You might think of some kind of Stanley Hauerwas groupie or something. I quoted him at lunch, and I quoted him in answering somebody's question after lunch, and I'm about to quote him again. I don't know how that happened. I assure you it's coincidence. He's not the only person I quote in my work. But Hauerwas wrote that he was once asked by a friend, how can you be a Christian at a place like Duke University? And that he said to his friend, where would you like me to be a Christian instead? And I think of that story, I wish I could feel it as strongly perhaps as he did, but I think of that story, and I think there's something to that. I was going to lunch with a friend of mine on the Yale faculty, and he was criticizing an article I'd recently written because I referred to God using a masculine pronoun. And he said, and I asked him what troubled him about it, and he said that he thought it was offensive to many people and in that sense divisive. And I said, well, I'm not claiming that God has gender, only that this is the way in which God chose to reveal himself, and I am not free to change it because someone else doesn't like it. I treat criticism lovingly, but I can't just say I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, no, he said it's very important. He started explaining to me all the reasons. I said, well, I'll tell you, and all the people would be offended and so on. I said, I'll tell you what. If you want to persuade me of that, of the importance of avoiding gendered pronouns when referring to God, will you join my campaign to get people to stop taking God's name in vain? Which I find offensive and is quite divisive. And all the things that he said I felt actually applied. In fact, I told him a story about my children in school actually being wounded and even in some sense depressed when they heard their classmates take God's name in vain when they were very small. Therefore, I said it affects their work, and I think we need to stamp this out. Would he join my campaign? And he said, that's very clever, he said. Well, all right. I want to talk about the secular academy in two of its different aspects. I want to talk about it from, if you will, the practical side, and then also from the theoretical side. That is to say, when I say the practical side, I simply am going to talk about some experiences I've had and some practical problems. When I say the theoretical side, I want to talk a little bit about liberal theory today and why and how I think it's gone so badly wrong in when it thinks about religion. But first, I should give you a little, to give you a little background, I should tell you what it is that I do at Yale with respect to religion. Here I want to speak of my scholarship. I've been writing for many years about law and religion and culture. My early work on this actually was about religion and science. I became interested in religion as a scholarly subject, interestingly, from teaching courses on law and science, which was the first thing that I taught really on technology assessment when I joined the Yale faculty back in the early 1980s. And what the vehicle through which my interest arose, which will then illustrate both of my both prongs of my argument, the vehicle through which my interest arose was in the course of teaching about law and religion. I inevitably taught the cases about the banning of the teaching of evolution in public schools or the efforts to teach scientific creationism alongside evolution later on. When I first started teaching these subjects back in 1982, I taught them, I think, the way that the great majority of professors of law, maybe 95% or more professors of law who teach these cases at American law schools, would teach them. I taught them as cases about particular religious sects trying to take control of the levers of government in general and of school in particular in order to proselytize for their religion. And that was the kind of thoughtless and easy way in which I taught them. It was a student, actually, who, after I've been doing this for a year or two, asked me if I'd ever read any of the literature. He didn't mean, say, creationist literature. He meant any of the writing by people who would explain why they wanted their children either not to study evolution and various other things they wanted their children not to study, or why they wanted their children to study creationism in school. And I will confess, and this is the narrowness of my perspective at the time, that until the student asked the question, I had never conceptualized these cases about being about parents and what they wanted their own children to learn. I conceptualized them as cases about what they wanted other children to learn. Only slowly did it dawn on me that these were really cases that arose about efforts of parents to control the education and upbringing of their own children, much more than the education and upbringing of other people's children. And that so, for example, some of the people who wanted the scientific creationism taught in schools explained it by saying they wanted their children to be taught the truth rather than a lie or an error. Now, this is quite independent of whether one actually believes that one story or the other is the truth or a lie. What was striking about it to me was that I had not thought of this previously as an epistemological problem, which indeed is what it is. And we can describe the epistemological problem this way. It's not about science, and it's not about law, and it's not even about public schools. It's about meaning. It's a problem about how life gets its meaning and from where. And as important, it's a problem about the transmission of that meaning over time. Because if you think about it, a lot of these cases arise because parents and the state are often in competition to provide meaning for young people, their own and sometimes other people's as well. And so a lot of these early cases, I think, are best understood as parents seeking to resist the set of meanings being impressed upon their children by the state. And in that sense, for a parent to say, I don't want my child to study evolution in school, whatever I personally might think of that decision, is not different from the cases, say, of parents who want their kids not to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in school or something like that. It's all part of this matter of parental authority. Once I looked at the cases that way, I began to wonder and perhaps worry about what is it about the public culture, and particularly about the culture of liberalism in America, that leads to the desire, the very strong desire, to inculcate in other people's children a particular set of meanings about life. Put otherwise, why are our battles over the curriculum of public schools so very, very intense? And the reason is, of course, because it's in the public schools that the future is shaped. Now, all of that is background to what I'm about to say. From that beginning, I began to be interested in questions of law and religion and questions of religion and culture. And one of the things I quickly discovered, maybe I should have known it, maybe I'm naive, is that in the secular academy, there is a correct way of understanding questions of law and religion and questions of religion and culture. And in particular, that in the secular academy, religion is widely viewed as a kind of interloper, a kind of pollutant in the pure waters of rational discourse. Remember I said at the beginning the question of why people think these things. In the view of the secular academy, there is a particular way of looking at the world that is seen as desirable and obviously correct. I would describe that way, I think it's correct to call that way liberal. And here, again, this is not liberalism in its political or polemical sense. It's liberalism in more of its humanistic sense. It's a way of understanding the world in which human beings themselves are the focus of any understanding of right and wrong. And indeed, that the human desire to do a thing, the human wanting itself, is an important datum in deciding what human beings ought to be doing. That in itself is perfectly unobjectionable. That's just a way of describing a regime of liberty, you might say. But the weakness in liberalism is that and this is nothing new to me, obviously. This is nothing I'm inventing. The weakness in liberalism is that liberalism presents a powerful theory about why humans should be free to enjoy a range of choices, but offers almost no assistance on how you decide which choices to make within that realm of freedom. And that question of how you decide what choices to make is a crucial question in religion generally and in Christianity in particular. And so I'm sure a lot of you have had the same experience as I in trying to, in raising our children, well, I used to say I sent them to a religious school, but that's not really true. It was an Episcopal school. But in raising our children, it was quite important to us for them to understand how different they were. It was quite important for us to that they realized that the fact that other children were doing a thing or seeing a thing, seeing a movie, having a particular book in the house, getting to a particular thing at a particular age, was not in and of itself a reason that they should be doing the same thing. We wanted our children from the beginning to understand the way that the faith in which we were raising them marked them as different. This led to all sorts of conflicts, not only with our children, but often with our children's schools. I remember our children's high school, which was not only a religious school, it was not an Episcopal school either, that we had our children... We held our children out of a series of courses about human sexuality, and it wasn't because there was any particular information in the courses that we were hiding from them. It was because of our strong belief that, in Christian terms, that questions of sexuality and questions of morality are deeply intertwined. And so when questions of sexuality are treated merely as questions about, say, desire and its satisfaction, that they are being given a different set of meanings about the world than the meanings that we were trying to teach. We were trying to help them see how to make a particular set of choices rather than simply to let them know that choices are available. Now, on campus, one of the things we quickly discovered is that the way that my wife and I tend to think about these questions is, to say the least, unpopular, and to say even more, is seen as downright bizarre. I said early on that the state and religion are in competition to provide meaning. I can only speak of this from the point of view of Christianity. It's nothing new to say that the secular world is, in some sense, an anti-religious world, and in many ways an anti-Christian world. It's nothing new to say that liberalism leaves little space for religion as a part of the discourse of the public square. I said before that part of the reason is competing epistemology. Part of the reason is the sense that religionists somehow make up their minds in a way that doesn't follow liberal standards of rationality. But there's more than that. I think you could also argue that a lot of the liberal response to Christianity today and religions in general is seen, it arises from a sense that religions themselves are in a sense illiberal. Illiberal in two different ways. One is they're illiberal in the internal organization, and the second is that they often seem to stand for principles that liberalism sees as wrong principles. That is to say, that religious faith might cause one to take a position that in liberal terms would be an incorrect position. I mention that because when we've seen historically religionists taking positions that are liberal in political terms, like, say, during the Civil Rights Movement, we didn't see complaint in the academy that there was something wrong with the religious discourse in public life. I've often pointed out to my students that when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was adopted, you had members of the House of Representatives on the floor of Congress defending their votes in favor of it in explicitly Christian terms. And at the time, no one seemed to think this was a great threat to the project of building a successful liberal state. And so when the Archbishop of New Orleans in the 1950s threatened to excommunicate Catholic legislators who voted in favor of a new school segregation bill, again, the only complaints came from segregationists. There was no sense of this as threatening the edifice of the modern state that liberalism was creating. So I think one can argue, and certainly some do, like Charles Taylor and others, and many others as well, that there is an aspect to which liberalism doesn't like religion in general, Christianity in particular, because of the sense that Christianity reaches all the wrong answers. But I would press a different point about Christianity and faith generally. I think that religions are at their best when they are resistant, when they're resisting, I mean, the culture around them. Nowadays, there are so many cultural winds that buffet religion, as there always have been. And some religions change slowly and some change quickly, and some try not to change at all. They don't succeed in not changing at all, but nevertheless they try. And when religion surrenders to the political or cultural passion of the moment, whether it's a passion of the left or a passion of the right, then at that moment a religion can begin to yield the transcendent character that marks religion as distinct among ways of understanding the world. And one sees this a lot. When I did a book a few years ago called God's Name in Vain, The Wrongs and Rights of Religion, in American Public Life. And in the course of that book, I talked to a number of pastors and of two particular kinds. I talked to evangelical pastors, both black and white. And this was for a reason. It was quite striking what developed, that there were a number of white evangelical pastors who would be described publicly, I think, in the way we think of these things, public life, as conservative, who told me that there were subjects that they didn't discuss from the pulpit because if they did, they would lose their conservative bona fides because of the views that they held. Similarly, there were African-American preachers who were seen as liberal who told me there were subjects they didn't discuss from the pulpit because of a fear of losing, if you will, their niche in the liberal order. That's what I mean by surrendering to the passion of the moment. It's not so much whether you change your mind. As someone reminded us, one of the questions reminded us this morning, it's important for all of us to go about our lives in a certain humility about what we believe. But it is important that if we decide we're wrong about what we believe, it's not because we're trying to fit in. It's because we've genuinely been persuaded of the error of what we believed before. So when in Romans 12 we read, do not conform any longer to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that is a crucial text of resistance. It's a crucial text when we think of a faith as standing against the culture that it's in. So when I live my life on campus, on a deeply liberal campus like Yale's, I nevertheless have to carve out this resisting space. And the point of the carving out isn't supposed to be a matter of pride. It's not supposed to be a matter of anything else but doing what I think I'm called to do among people who disagree with me. So, for example, next week I'm going to speak to the Yale Political Union. And my topic there is why we should abolish the separation of church and state. And what I mean by that is the liberal conception of the separation of church and state, in which the state is in a superior position and religion in an inferior position, that religious life in the modern state is life that is lived within a set of legalistic boundaries carved out by the state itself. These are the particular rights that you have as a religionist, and here is where your rights stop. That vision of faith has nothing to do with the separation of church and state and everything to do with the elevation of the state over the church. So that's what I'm going to talk about next week. When I teach just and unjust war, we don't read only or even mainly secular texts. I've taught it both in the law school and to undergraduates at Yale. And we read a lot of theology. We read a little bit of non-Western religious work, too, but mainly we read both contemporary and historical Christian texts, because that is where the context of the material comes from. In one of the times I taught the course, when I explained on the first day that we'd be reading these Christian texts, a couple of students stood up and walked out of the class and were never seen there again. And I'm not doing that because I'm trying to be in anyone's face. I'm doing that in part as a measure of resistance and also in part as a measure of intellectual honesty. I don't want to bury somehow within the course the fundamental texts that shape it. In this sense, I guess I'm a little bit influenced by people like John Milbank and Catherine Pickstock and people like that. I wouldn't say that I'm quite a member of the radical orthodoxy movement, in part because I'm not theologian enough to be able to define it correctly. But when I read their work, one of the things that's quite striking to me is the notion of not yielding to the secular space, the notion that you begin with the secular and everything else is the add-on. Catherine Pickstock has this rather nice image where she says the problem with secularism is the secular view, even if there's a God, there's the universe too. You see, that the universe is this other thing which you can also study instead of studying God. And her point is, and then my point as well, is that if you study the universe that way, you may learn a great deal about it, but you're also missing the universe. If you study it as anything other than an extension of God's creation, at least that seems to me to be what I as a Christian think about studying the universe. When my kids were in high school, they went to a school that taught, as it called it, the Old Testament as literature, in which they would read, they didn't read all the Old Testament, they read about 8 books of the Old Testament, and in reading those books, they were supposed to treat them through modern tools of literary criticism. And we had a lot of fun with that, in a sense, because our kids would be writing these papers. And we didn't usually read this score, but we'd run and look at this. And we'd say to them, well, you know, you've got to say this and this, because they would be adding things at their parents' behest, I admit, that said things like, instead of saying, this demonstrates that these books have different authors. Just where they'd say many believe, you see, that these books have different authors. Now, back to the problem of the campus, and then I realize I've already gone more than the half an hour I said I was going to take, and I didn't even get to my main point about the campus yet. That's all right. Back to the campus, and I do actually have a main point to make. There are a couple of stories about my own university that I think illustrate the heart of the problem, and these two that I'm about to tell actually do appear, fortunately, in the article that that I sent along to the commentators. So these are two stories. So a few years ago at Yale Law School, we faced the following dilemma. The Christian Legal Society wanted to come and recruit lawyers at Yale Law School, but only wanted to hire Christians, which would violate the placement policy at Yale. So they asked for an exemption. That's story number one. Story number two involves a group of Orthodox Jewish students who came to Yale as freshmen and then applied for special permission not to live in the dormitories. Yale requires all students to live in the dormitories unless they're over 25 or married. And these students were neither over 25 nor married. They were Orthodox Jewish students, and they wanted not to live in the dormitories because they believed, and from all I can tell correctly, that the atmosphere in the Yale dormitory strongly encourages people to engage in premarital sexual activities and other sexual activities which they were supposed not to engage in, and they thought they shouldn't be forced to live in a place where they would be tempted to engage in such activities. So they asked for permission to live off campus, which Yale denied, and Yale also denied permission for the Christian Legal Society to recruit. Now, if you think about it, in liberal terms, both these decisions make sense. The Christian Legal Society is denied permission to recruit in liberal terms because it's discriminating. And the students are denied permission in liberal terms because, after all, nobody forces you to do anything. So to refer to temptation as a danger just wasn't very persuasive to the Yale administration. By the way, the then dean of Yale College also argued that if that's what the students believe, they should want to live in the dorms in order to persuade other people to follow their faith. Now, what both of these stories illustrate is a severe disconnection between these two epistemologies I mentioned at the beginning. That's between the religious, you might say, way of looking at the world and the secular way of looking at the world. That Yale was unable to see these arguments, these claims, in anything other than liberal terms. And in liberal terms, it's true, the claims are slightly incoherent. But you notice what therefore happens, that when you reject people's claims to be treated differently because of their faith, then what you're doing is, interestingly, in the name of diversity, you're making the world less diverse. The reason that resistance is so important is precisely so that everyone will not end up, the reason it's so important to democracy is precisely so that everyone will not end up thinking the same way. A university, it seems to me, and this is true of any great university, whether it has a religious connection or not, is the last place where that should be organized around the proposition that everybody should, in the end, believe the same things. My view about being at Yale is I've always thought it ought to value the differences, including the sharp religious differences among its students and faculty. And when I say value them, I don't mean tolerate them in the sense that we can proudly trumpet, we have people of several different religions, but actually recognize that sometimes a part of truly valuing that diversity is creating space for it. The liberal state has trouble creating that space because in the end there's a deep sense that there's a right way to look at the world that everyone ought to follow that right way of looking at the world. The religious believer in that space has an obligation to resist that pressure, resist that effort to make everyone the same. The students have petitioned for these and other exemptions, which are always denied, are the resistors. They are the people trying to keep a campus diverse. But it should be no surprise that the secular university resists this kind of diversity because the larger culture resists it as well. We think of the Supreme Court as the guardian of religious freedom. And a lot of people have run religious freedom cases in the Supreme Court. But they've all been Christians. They've all been Christians. No non-Christian has ever won a religious freedom case in the Supreme Court of the United States. It's quite a remarkable and interesting truth, but it's still a truth. No non-Christian has ever won a religious freedom case in the Supreme Court of the United States. I mention that because to win a religious freedom case almost always means the state accedes to your demand to be treated differently instead of the same as everyone else because of your religious faith. Those cases are hard to win. Not a lot of people win the demand to be treated differently. I think more people should. And they don't win in part because the court is also caught up in the same secular sense of there being one meaning. My larger point, though, is that the campus is that way, too. The campus is a place that imposes a particular meaning through all sorts of pressures, large and small, the secular campus, I mean. And that imposed meaning is the enemy of diversity and the enemy of religion in particular. One last point that I want to make. I said a moment ago that liberalism is attractive in its core. What I mean by that is the defense of a state that creates a broad range of choices for people. This seems to me to be the conception of liberalism that we teach, say, in the philosophy classroom, the Rawlsian liberalism, liberalism as neutral among competing conceptions of the good. This is a powerful and attractive argument. But over the last couple of decades, a lot of academic philosophy has become dominated by what some call muscular liberalism, the notion that liberalism should not be neutral as among competing conceptions of the good, in fact, ought to teach and press a particular theory of the good and to repress those who don't agree. Thus, there's been a rise, for example, over the last two decades of literature in both law reviews and philosophical journals, arguing that not only should religionists not have special accommodations made for them under law, but they should actually be treated in certain ways worse with respect to various benefits and other things than others in order to encourage them to abandon their illiberal positions. This has been a growing view of a lot of perfectly serious people on campus. And that view, I think, reflects exactly what I'm talking about. It is the hubris of thinking that there is one right set of choices and that the campus ought to impose them. What makes this dangerous is that our campuses are the places where the future is trained. And I'd like to believe, by the way, that it's different on a campus where there's a formal connection to a church. But I wonder sometimes. I was speaking at a religious school, I don't want to say which one because I don't want to embarrass anyone, a few years ago, a school that is seen as pretty, I guess we describe in secular terms, as pretty conservative. And after my talk, a couple of students came up to me and they were telling me of their experiences in the school. They happened to be pro-life. And they said they never told anybody they were pro-life because they were afraid of being attacked, not by their fellow students, but by their professors in the classroom. That's exactly the sort of pressure I'm talking about. I've seen that at Yale. In fact, I have a student who was sitting in my office just a couple of years ago who wanted to be a law professor. She is now a law professor, and she's a well-known feminist legal scholar who never writes about abortion. And she told me when she was in my office a few years ago that she's a pro-life feminist, as she described herself. But she said she can't tell anybody that, because then they'll decide she's not a real feminist, because she's pro-life, and she's made this career as a feminist legal scholar without telling anybody that. Without ever, you read her work, and it has this powerful, radical gender critique, and it never mentions abortion anywhere. She keeps that out of her work because she wants to keep that under wraps. It's that pressure to keep it under wraps that I'm talking about. That, it seems to me, is what religionists have to resist, and we have to resist it wherever we are. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. Most of my remarks are prepared, but I'll end with a few off-the-cuff remarks, partly motivated by having been a student at Yale in the late 90s, and not having all of the material in front of me to prepare the remarks ahead of time. I'll be a bit off the cuff at the end. When I arrived at the University of Pennsylvania in the late 90s to begin my doctoral studies, I entered the Department of Religious Studies at a momentous moment in its history. It had just moved into a newly renovated building at the center of campus, away from its previous digs on the top floor of a slightly broken-down house somewhere a few blocks away. It wasn't the ample new sofas in the lounge that made the move momentous, although it did make it comfortable. It was instead the fact that religious studies had been slated to be cut as a department in the mid-90s, and it was the concerted lobbying of my advisor that not only avoided this fate, but brought the department into a central position on the map of the campus. The debate, as it was explained to me, had been over the necessity for a religious studies program at all, as a fair number of professors in other departments assumed that we were teaching our students to be religious rather than analyzing religious practice and belief in its historical and cultural aspects. After all, they argued, the Quaker William Penn had founded the University of Pennsylvania as a secular university, refusing to build a chapel precisely in the interests of promoting religious freedom. And clearly, their point of view, rooted in liberalism, as Dr. Carter has pointed out, talking about religion at all was imposing religion on others. My advisor was successful in saving the department, not only by educating her colleagues on what we were actually engaged in, but also by making a winning argument out of the fact that the religious studies program was necessary because so many colleagues, especially in the history department, refused to treat religion at all in their classes. They were so worried about teaching students to be religious that they refused to admit it as an intrinsically important phenomena in the world, past or present. Classes on European and American history, for example, were taught from economic, cultural, political, and military perspectives, but not the religious. It seems bizarre to me, and presumably to all in this room, to ignore religion in history, as religion, of course, is the actual or rhetorical foundation for an extraordinary variety of economic, cultural, political, and military endeavors over several millennia of recorded history. But of course, historians are not bizarre on the subject of religion alone. Historians were perfectly willing through the 1970s, and some still today, to happily ignore 50% of humanity in their writing of history. A discipline comfortable ignoring all women might easily morph into a discipline comfortable ignoring all persons with a faith commitment. Historians, and I speak as one, have blinkers, always. A few years into my graduate studies, after having decided to specialize in the history of spiritual and mystical practices in late medieval and early modern Spain, I took a course in the Romance Languages department on the literature of my era. I was quite excited to be beginning to specialize, and a few weeks into the course, I went up to the professor to ask if she could recommend some good overviews of late medieval religion in Spain. She said, simply and abruptly, no. She wasn't interested in religion, so she didn't read about it, so she didn't know the bibliography. Now, for one, late medieval Spain's defining characteristic is that it was the era of convivencia, of both conquest and cooperation between the three Abrahamic religions, with Christians and Muslims struggling for control of the peninsula and the Jews caught in between, but all often sharing philosophic, scientific, architectural, and artistic knowledge. The notion that any medievalist who specializes in Spain doesn't do religion is baffling. Furthermore, this particular professor, who shortly after I took her class left UPenn for Princeton, had built her Ivy League career on a book that compared Augustine's Confessions to Juan Ruiz's Book of Good Love. Ruiz's work is a famous series of tales purportedly written by a Spanish archpriest that describes the rollicking good times that priests, nuns, Christians, Jews, and Muslims had in a variety of salacious scandals. It is also a book that begins and ends with hymns to the Virgin Mary and describes Carnival, Lent, and Holy Week at great length in its pages. It strikes me as naive and even academically unethical to not study religion because it doesn't interest you if you were writing monographs on Catholicism's most famous theologian and Spain's era of convivencia. But again, of course, to not study something because it doesn't interest you, even though it was critical to the authors or eras you study, is a studied ignorance that is not applied only to religion. Scholars from every academic discipline have, for a long time, and many still today, happily ignored the gender, race, class, orientation, or disability status of the subjects they discuss, because it isn't an element of social location that they share, and therefore isn't something they are interested in examining, regardless of its centrality to their subjects' lives and motivations. So while I agree with Dr. Carter that secular academe has a problem with religion, I also think that this is a fact of life, for academics are, after all, as little as we'd like to admit it, human. Regardless of our discipline or the era we study, there are some things we can see and some we can't, some that we accept and construe as vital, and some we dismiss. So as frustrated as those two stories I just told made me at the time, which was greatly, nowadays I think it's actually more interesting to think about those who do accept religion as vital in academe. In other words, to think about UPenn's religious studies department, rather than all those on question who questioned its necessity, its goals, or professed disinterest in its topic. In comparison to the rest of Penn graduate programs, our students and professors were certainly more likely to be active members at a church, temple, mosque, or a practitioner of Zen, Jain, etc. I would guess that at least 50% were, outside of their studies and teaching, also participants in a specific faith tradition, though not necessarily the one they studied. 50% here at Perkins probably doesn't sound like much, but since perhaps 10% of any other graduate department had that profile, it was fairly clear that personal religious views affected the choice of study for many in the department. But I use the verb, I guess, that 50%, because I don't actually know. I picked up over the course of about 6 years that various of my professors and fellow students were active in a faith community, but only in casual conversation, and quite often after knowing them academically for a long time. Even though we were all committed to the importance of religion, most of us dedicating 40, 60, even 80 hours a week to writing and teaching about it, we did not bring the discourse of individual faith to the conversations we had. In addition, most of us were intrinsically suspicious of the use of religious discourse in public life, especially politics. I'd like to talk with you all a little bit as to why, mostly because in Perkins specifically, in Dallas and Texas more generally, religious discourse in all aspects of life, personal and professional, is not only welcomed, but a little overwhelming. When I was in the midst of my degree in religious studies, specializing in the history of medieval Christian thought, I had to prepare for and take 4 doctoral exams. Each exam covered a book list that I developed in consultation with my committee of about 35 primary and secondary texts. One exam on my general era, one on my primary topic, one on a subfield, and one on my dissertation topic. The general era exam for a medievalist turned out to be defined as Christianity from Augustine to Luther, a time frame of over 13 centuries. The question quickly became, how do you choose 35 texts by Christian authors and modern scholars to represent 1,300 years? The answer was, you can't. For every theologian you include, because he has been read extensively over time, you have to exclude a popular devotional practice, a powerful preacher, or a form of communal life that allowed women and men equal voice. Likewise, for every heretic or religious war that you include, you have to exclude a mendicant movement, or a pope, or a scholastic. For every history of Christian renewal, you have to cut out a history of Christian inquisition, or economic history. The first and foremost lesson of developing my own book list, rather than reading through a standardized set provided by my professors, was that there was and is no single version of Christianity, medieval, early modern, or contemporary, that can be encapsulated by one set of sources or one methodology. As a result of this training, I teach an intro to the history of Christianity, where I include a little of all those things that I'd had to choose between. More importantly, I start my class by stating that we study the history of those who have called themselves Christian, not just those whom society or history has deemed to be Christian. In other words, the early modern Spanish men and women who insisted to the inquisitorial boards that they were good and true Christians, despite consorting with the devil and renouncing Christ, because they had never renounced the Virgin Mary, were expressing as considered and complex a version of Christianity as a pope who relied on just war theory, or as a modern evangelical who calls on Jesus as her foremost daily friend. It is this understanding of Christianity as an extraordinary range of practices and beliefs that is at the core of my own historical study. I quite frankly would be uninterested in being a historian of Christianity were there such a thing as a Christian tradition or a Christian viewpoint that had functioned univocally over centuries. Given this perspective, those in my department at UPenn were exceedingly wary of interventions into politics or university structures that use religious, specifically Christian, argument as their basis when those arguments are constructed as Christians believe, or the Christian view on this political or academic or moral topic is X. These arguments erase the diversity that I see as core to the historical reality of Christianity. I bracket the theological argument of whether Christians ought to be diverse in favor of the historical reality of diversity. And they erase that diversity in favor of winning the argument. It is more effective rhetorically, or so one supposes, to say that the weight of authority of the tradition lies behind the view you present. At this point, those claiming to articulate the Christian viewpoint are articulating it as hegemonic and univocal in the interest of ending the debate, not engaging in it civilly. I agree with Dr. Carter's point that he makes in several of his books that arguing politics or academics without admitting to the source of your passion is problematic. But there's a difference between articulating my own rationale for my point of view, be it methodological, historical, experiential, biblical, or some combination, and assuming that my rationale speaks for others who theoretically share my social location as an academic, or as a person of faith, or as a person not of faith. In other words, looking back on it, I think the reason that the members of UPenn's Religious Studies Department did not speak from a faith position, despite dedicating 40 to 80 hours a week to the topic of religion and 50% participating in a faith, was in the interest of not slipping into the discourse of all Christians, Jews, Muslims, Jains believe X, which as a Christian, Jew, Muslim, Jain, I can represent accurately. We did not avoid speaking from individual religious motivations because we were secular. We did not speak of religion because we were ashamed of being religious, or because our colleagues in other departments scoffed at religion. But in order to resist having a flattening effect in which somehow my personal view became the view of all my co-religionists, we resisted this flattening effect because we cared about religion, because we honored its discourses and motivations, and above all, its extraordinary complexity, and therefore did not want to collapse it into a simplistic, holistic unity. Sometimes, to not speak from within a particular religious discourse isn't a case of denying that religious discourse validity. To not speak religiously from a position of power may be done with the religious intention of honoring the enormous range of religious views that are present in your audience, even when all in your audience identify with a religious tradition, even when all identify with the same religious tradition. Not everyone present here today is Christian. And everyone here today who identifies as Christians agrees with every iota of what every other self-identified Christian here today would argue. Some probably don't agree with a single iota of what the other self-identified Christians here would argue. To not speak of today's audience as we Christians, to not say what we as Christians all do, or all should do, on topics of politics, sexuality, etc., is both an academic and a religious refusal to erase the individuality, the complexity, the diversity that is the core of Christianity as it has been lived out throughout the centuries and is present in this room. A couple of further comments on the notion of resistance. I'm more eloquent when writing, so I apologize. I think the case of the Orthodox Jews attempting to live off campus at Yale has a couple of complexities I'd like to push a little bit. One is which that it's not the case that you live on, that you're required to live on campus for 4 years. You're required to live on campus for your first year, and then you can opt out. Or at least in the 90s, you could. Secondly, I believe the secular viewpoint, at least according to some, was not to wipe out their religious right, but rather to the religious right to avoid certain attitudes, but was rather with the idea of bringing them into diversity. That is to say, by coming onto campus, they and people on campus would be enriched by their viewpoint on sexuality. It's also true that although that the notion that Yale undergraduate dorms promote, I don't know, burgeoning sexuality or whatever you want to call it, there are people who explore many things while undergraduates at Yale. You can resist whatever dominant discourse you see. You can participate in it. Choosing to participate in it isn't necessarily giving in. Choosing to opt out isn't necessarily being square. And I think that bringing, I think the idea, I think you were making a distinction between, or you were making the point that this was erasing diversity by not allowing them to live off of campus. It was both promoting and erasing in different ways of understanding that. The other point I want to make about the notion of Christian resistance, so no, and I'm not sure how much you said about this today, but in the article you sort of put Christian resistance against being overtaken by secularity, as though culture and Christianity are always in conflict. Which, as a historian, where the words and expressions and the devotional practices come out of culture, come into culture, that's something that's impossible to distinguish, I think is a little bit complicated. But I think another way of looking at it is if Christianity is going to resist dominant culture, it doesn't have to allow its discourse to be constructed against that culture. That is to say, what people say are the important topics to debate. What people in politics say, for example, don't have to be central to Christianity just because the secular world is saying that. And I'm going to give an example, which is, I'm not sure whether this comes out of Christianity or it comes out of politics, but the major divisive issue in politics whenever we have candidates and in a lot of Christian denominations right now is gay marriage. And you are presumed to be liberal or conservative, religious or not, depending where you stand on that issue. If Christianity is going to resist and not allow its own discourse to be produced by the secular society, the question may not be gay marriage or not. The question, the more fundamental question, it seems to me, is whether marriage should be the central question in society. Throughout the history of Christianity, marriage has not been central to Christians' self-conception of their world. Whether it be asceticism, monastics, mendicants, movements in the late medieval period called modern devotion, who set up houses where men and women lived in common life, religious life, specifically opting out of society's understanding of marriage as connecting to families or connecting to businesses or sets of land. Christianity has periodically and frequently throughout its history problematized that institution as the central question of how it is to be in relationship to God. Christianity, well, besides the fact that as a sacrament, it was only made a sacrament about halfway through the history of Christianity, Christian resistance, it seems to me, would be more complex if it resisted the categories that other people are identifying as important in politics or important in culture, not just resisting the dominant answer. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
we need a semester seminar with Professor Carter and not an afternoon symposium. Over a series of years now, he's given us a number of important books in which he's explored constructively and insightfully a bunch of thorny issues having to do with religion and public policy in all its aspects. And I'm very grateful for that body of work and have learned a lot from it. Not as much as I should have, but I've learned a lot. And I just want to open with that word of appreciation and also with the hope that somehow or other we'll be able to continue this conversation even in his absence, only with his presence in absentia through his writing and our memories. I have 2 points to make, if all goes well. Bill mentioned I'm a ordained minister. You know ministers and priests make various meaningful gestures liturgically, and you know also that this is a meaningless gesture. But the more meaningful fact is that Todd is sitting here in the front row with his stopwatch, so I know our time is limited. Let me try 2 points, each of them taking up on a comment that Professor Carter made in his talk just now. First, he identified himself as a Christian believer in the secular academy. I take it he means by that he is a Christian believer who happens to find himself in the secular academy, as he's defined secular academy. I want to say that I'm a Christian believer in the secular academy in another sense. I'm a proponent of the secular academy as a Christian believer. Of course, that leads me to say there's another sense of secular operating here as well. What he talks about as the secular academy, I think, might be more fairly described as the secularist academy, academy that has a kind of ideological conviction that religious discourse is nonsense, or at least it has no business in our affairs. It ought to be excluded on principle. That's secularism. My idea of secular really stems from another sense of secularity rather than secularism, a secularity that a lot of theologians, Jewish and Christian in particular, have found rooted in biblical faith, in monotheism, the idea that the world is God's good creation, but it's distinct from God, right? And there's a kind of healthy common sense realism about how we can engage with our fellow creatures, not mistaking them for God, and not mistaking our own ideas for divine ideas either, for that matter. There's a kind of freedom to engage with the world, with all of our rational capacities and so on, that comes from the sort of biblical grounding in creation faith. So it's that sense of secular that I have in mind when I'd say that I would be a proponent, precisely as a Christian, of a secular academy. Let me say just a little more about this point. And for this, I'm going to engage in a little... I'm going to go back to an ancient text from 1911, precisely. The Articles of Incorporation of Southern Methodist University. The purpose for which this corporation is formed is for the support of an educational undertaking, to wit, the establishment, maintenance, and support of an institution of higher learning, including education and instruction in literary, scientific, theological, vocational, and professional branches. Said educational institution to be forever owned, maintained, and controlled by the South Central jurisdiction of the Methodist Church. Now, notice the mention of theological learning as an integral part of the purposes for which this university was founded. It seems to me that that affirmation and that statement of purpose is entirely compatible with the idea of a secular academy as I was just advocating it, or at least announcing my allegiance to it. I think, though, as the history of SMU has unfolded and of institutions similar to it, we might want to expand the sense of theological to be a little more inclusive, so that it isn't, at least by implication, just Christian theology that's included here. A university that you might say is open to normative religious inquiry. Is what's being had in mind here. Well, that's so much by way of touching on my first point. Now, I have to grant, before I go to the second point, that Professor Carter's distinction between the theoretical and the practical
is an important one not to lose sight of here. There are all sorts of ways in which we are far at SMU from being a secular university, in my sense, practically, and much closer maybe to a secularist university. That's something on which we can work a lot. Second point, his mention that, his affirmation, I should say, that religions are at their best when they're engaged in resistance. That's very Hauerwasian. and I think, if I may put it this way, it's an important half-truth. Because it tells half the story. Religions are at their best when they're engaged in resistance. But there is something else that religions, particularly Christianity and Judaism, have to be engaged in, it seems to me. Many biblical and biblical theologians, both Christian and Jewish, have also pointed out that there's a kind of dialectic running through the Hebrew canon and the Christian canons of Scripture. A dialectic between, you might say, the critical and the constructive, between the prophetic and the constitutive, or maybe priestly, though that doesn't quite get to it, side of things. Christians are often engaged in resistance out of their faith. They're also committed generally to constructive engagement with the culture, with, and not just with the culture as an abstraction, but with their neighbors, with Christian and non-Christian, Jewish and non-Jewish neighbors. And I would like to nudge Professor Carter, and he probably has strong reasons for not being receptive to this kind of nudge, but I would like to nudge him for a little more consideration of a non-Hauerwasian approach to ethics and theology that might provide a little more room for that kind of constructive engagement. There are all sorts of signs in what he says by way of amplification of these points that he's quite open to that. And I'd just like to probe a little more the relation between that general affirmation that I find often in your work, that resistance is what we're all about, and the alternative to resistance is surrender, and nobody wants to do that. There may be some other options there to be considered. I think I'll leave it at that and leave us at least a few moments for some discussion with Professor Carter. And again, just with an appreciation to him.
Can I say two words?
Please.
Should I say them from here?
Yeah.
I want to say, first of all, I'll be very brief. I appreciate these both very thoughtful commentaries, both of which had a lot that I agreed with. And I want to single out things I agreed with very briefly. First, I should say I do agree strongly that a part of resistance is not letting the dialogue itself be constructed by the needs of exactly the entity you're trying to resist, so that the notion that the agenda of the faith should be driven by whatever's driving everybody else strikes me as bizarre. And I do think it's strange. The things that churches end up getting divided over. I don't mean it's strange if they're not difficult issues. I mean it's strange that we select those issues to fight over. And so I agree with that entirely. But I think I slightly have a different take, but I want to go back to the Orthodox Jews at Yale. I understand that the university's public posture was, well, they should be part of diversity and so on. But the outcome of that struggle was quite interesting. And I think Yale comes out the worst in the outcome. Here was the compromise Yale came up with. Yale said, well, we don't care, and it was just freshman year, whether you live in the dorms or not, as long as you pay room and board. They made that clear fairly early on. So it turned out that for Yale, all these other things they talked about, where it was actually just money was the issue. Now, I'm not money is fine, it has its place, but the great principles they talked about actually were significantly less important. From the point of view of the Orthodox students, some of whom I met with, they were sensitive to Yale's concern, but their view was they didn't want to be exhibits. That's what one of them said. They didn't want to be an exhibit. He wasn't there in school to let other people experience him. Now, maybe that was, in some sense, not sufficiently generous. I don't know. He and I actually talked about that. And I know there were people at Yale who thought that these students, some of these students intentionally chose Yale because they had this policy, because they wanted to make a to-do about it. I have no idea if that's true or not. But on the merits, my larger point is that Yale institutionally over the years has not, I think, been sensitive to religious claims of difference. Another example is Mormon missions. Yale has a rule that was adopted back in the 60s, that if you leave school for more than 1.5 semesters for any reason other than military service as an undergraduate, you cannot be readmitted until you've successfully completed a semester at a school that Yale has to approve of for you to attend. The Mormon mission is 2 years. Mormon students who I also worked with tried to get an exemption to that. Yale didn't grant them. What was striking was that Yale was unable to articulate a justification for the policy itself in the refusal to grant an exemption, at least with the other students, they articulated an exemption. But for your larger point, I entirely agree with your point about the selection of the agenda. As to the question of why people of faith don't speak in faith terms sometimes, I quite agree there's the risk of flattening Christians that you speak of and of treating Christianity as univocal. On the other hand, that risk attends virtually any perspective out of which we teach, whether one says this is what liberalism teaches, what conservatism teaches, what neoclassical economics teaches. That risk is always going to be there. I don't like it when people say, oh, well, because I'm a Christian, I must believe X. But I think it's enormously useful when one says, let me suggest to you some of what my faith might bring to bear on this question as a way of inviting rather than ending dialogue. Now, on the question of Howard Wassian, it was just a coincidence. I'm more of a Niebuhr guy. Okay, I absolutely believe in religion and dialogue with the culture. The resistance point is not so much that you've got to build a wall around the garden and never let the world enter sin. It's more a sense that in the end, even though it is true historically that you can't separate religion and culture in a strong way, and yet you've got to struggle with it. You've got to struggle with figuring out if you believe in a life, a faith life that is guided by what God wants of us, if one believes that, then figuring out what God wants of us is not identical to doing what everybody else wants of us. It's kind of like, you know, there are a lot of people who search for a church where they're politically comfortable. Here I mean in secular political terms. I want to go to school with liberals or conservatives, something like that. And my view is, you know, if people want to do that, I can tell them where to go to church. On the other hand, if we're never changed by our encounter with the faith, if it never makes us different than what we were going in, it probably hasn't been much of an encounter.
I have a covenant with Jessica. She is teaching at our program in Houston, Galveston. She has to go catch a plane. I said I would let her out of here at 5:30 so she could keep this covenant and I would keep my covenant with hers. Jessica, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I hope that this is a dialogue we can continue with her as well. We are at our ending hour, but I want to give us a chance at least to begin dialogue. If you get a sense that this is a much more complex issue and we've raised more questions than we'll ever get the answer to, then welcome to our world. That's what we do, and you'll leave here with what we hope you leave with, and that is not answers, but how we can begin to probe the questions together. So let's see if we have a few questions that we could maybe get and drill deeper together with. So, anyone that's not shy, I'm going to hand you the mic because we are recording.
Thank you so much. I have a question based on Professor Carter mentioning that much of what was going on in this division was epistemological. And in...
Didn't we just have this conversation?
Yes, sir. But I actually have the question in terms of the response, because in the responses, I think that there were maybe different epistemologies even at work and what was, say, constitutive of education, and in terms of what's constitutive of education in a place like this. For instance, all students at Perkins that are MDivs are required to do spiritual formation. So part of what is considered education in an institution like this would be catechesis or habituation, something like that, which I would assume would both fit with a Hauerwasian Milbank sort of understanding.
It's a coincidence.
Right, a coincidence. but I think that it might be something that's part of the larger sort of trajectory. So that in Dr. Boone's response, she said that the students would be enriched by views on sexuality that these Orthodox Jewish people had that were resistant, whereas what the Orthodox Jewish people seemed to be asking was something that they did not want to be habituated into a different sort of world, a different sort of education. So in terms of education, are we looking at secularity just as propositions to be bantered about or agreed upon or disagreed upon, or in terms of some sort of Aristotelian habituation? I don't know if that's a direct enough question, but that's sort of the question that I'm raising in the dialogue.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Well, again, very, very briefly, because I know we're pressed for time, you've hit upon something that's quite important. I've done a little bit of writing about it. I'm sure that people here have thought about it much more deeply than I. But what you referred to as habituation is exactly, I think, what the Orthodox Jewish students at Yale were concerned about. And when I speak of these competing epistemologies, my point about liberalism is not there's anything wrong with its epistemology. It's that when the epistemology becomes dominant, when there's the sense that everybody ought to think about things this way, when liberalism is no longer liberal about competing views of the world, that's where the problem, I think, arises. Now, I was teasing about lunch. After my luncheon talk, this young man, I don't remember your name, I'm sorry, asked me about my views of ideology and partisanship and how it, the role it plays in dialogue. I mentioned it because I think it's relevant to the answer to that question. I think one of the reasons that, I mean, no one sees the world cleanly. No one sees the world as it is. We see the world through a lens, and the lens is a function of education and cultural experience and a lot of other things. And so one of the reasons for this, these battles is we're battling over who's going to figure out what that lens is. And parents, by and large, religious parents, non-religious parents, parents of different backgrounds and faiths, want to be the custodians of that lens. They want to figure it out. Over historically, if you look at education, education also tries to give you a lens, sometimes competing with parents, sometimes agreeing with them. If you look at the educational system in the United States in the late 19th century, at the time of the rise of compulsory education laws, the rise of compulsory education laws in the United States, it runs alongside the rise in immigration to the United States, the great wave of European immigrants, many of them Roman Catholic. And you see in the writings of many of the great supporters of public education in the United States in the 19th century a sense that children have to be Americanized, by which they meant weaned away from what was seen as their foreign faith and turned into what would be seen at the time as good American Protestants. That's competition over the lens. That's competition over who gets to decide how you see the world. Same thing happened with the Jewish immigrants. The interesting difference was that the Catholic immigrants, the result was the rise of the Catholic school. And, of course, the network of Catholic schools we have in the United States is unknown to the rest of the world. No one has anything quite like it. And that was a response, an effort to know we want a different lens. Interestingly, Jewish immigrants had a different response, by and large. It was to try to stay in the public schools and to change them, to change the curriculum, to reduce the degree of Protestantization. And these are two perfectly legitimate, although at the time very different responses, but all fighting over the same thing, which is the construction of this lens by which young people, as they grow up, are going to view the world.
Dr. Wood, would you like to? Don't want to put you on the spot, but I want to give you an opportunity.
No, let's have another question.
Okay, great. Someone else have a question?
I think, thank you, first of all, Professor Carter, this, and I think it all ties in, but and I'm especially interested as your role within the law discipline of where the question of adjudication comes in, especially with these differing epistemologies. And, I mean, practically there needs to be some measure of adjudication, but where does that come in and how does that look differently? Is it diversity? Is it parental? Is it, you know, toward the common good? So I would just like to hear you talk about that.
I want to make sure that I understand the question correctly. When you refer to adjudication, are you referring to by courts? Is that what you're thinking about? Or are you talking about deciding among these different epistemologies? And so
well, I mean, I think you have a unique position here, being in the law school at Yale. So I guess either way, especially, you know, as you were talking about law and religion and, you know, how these decisions get meted out, I guess.
I see. Oh, I see. Well, let me give you a short answer to that, and if it doesn't answer, you can come back to me. I think one of the really important points that Dr. Wood made in his comments a moment ago, one of those points you hear and then you wish you'd made it, is that in religions, resistance is a part of what religions do, and engagement is a part. And the engagement part I haven't talked about very much, probably because I've been so depressed in recent years, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. But the engagement part is actually quite important. And so for me as a law professor, as I write scholarship about how courts should do this and that, it's not that every article I write I would say is saying, let me give you a Christian perspective on this. I would say that the articles that I write on subjects about what rules, how courts should decide this and that, are informed to a large degree by my faith, sometimes explicitly, sometimes not. And in that sense, for me, there's an act of engagement. It's not that I want courts to issue decisions that are based on a religious view of the world. It's rather that my religious view helps inform the kinds of decisions I think courts should issue. Let me give one small example of what I mean. I said that no non-Christian has ever won a religious freedom case in the Supreme Court, which is really quite striking. And without looking at any doctrine, for me as a believer, and this I hope is whether I'm a Christian or not, that's already a problem. That is that simple fact. It's difficult to imagine that in all of American history, with all of the many religious freedom cases that have come to the Supreme Court, that by some remarkable coincidence, only Christians have ever had good arguments. This doesn't seem to me to... Now, I'm not saying every Christian wins, by the way. Most Christians lose, too. But the only ones that win are ever Christians. And it strikes me that we ought to be especially solicitous of religious faiths that have little political power. Politically powerful faiths, by and large, can protect themselves. It's really quite striking. In one of the cases in which Native American groups lost in the 1980s, the court majority says the right place to go to resolve these problems is politics, not the courtroom. And I would like to imagine a world in which that's actually the right answer. But as a practical matter, people who follow what we think of as outlier religions, religions that seem peculiar to everybody else, can't win in court and have very little political power. In the paper that I distributed, I mentioned followers of Santeria. Now, I'm not a follower of Santeria. I don't understand it that well, and there are aspects of it that scare me. I'll be very clear. So I'm not. This isn't out of. But on the other hand, so what? You see that none of that is relevant to the issue of religious freedom at all. And the religious freedom claim, with some important exceptions, is treated very hostily by courts, as are a lot of claims by non-Western or non-traditional religions. So without being able to answer the question about adjudication, I want to make clear that part of my engagement of my faith in the world is the way in which my faith influences my theories about what I think courts should do. But this is not without regard to saying they ought to hand down Christian doctrine, rather that as a believer I have a sense they ought to be more sensitive to believers, I guess is one way to think about it.
I'm sorry. We have come to the hour that we just simply have to stop because we have deadlines we have to meet. I want to thank our speakers again. Please join me in thanking them.